Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and on the program today, we'll be talking about Utah's response to the repeal of the immigration program DACA, concerns that immigration officials are using a Utah driver card database to round up undocumented workers, and the latest in the story of a U of U hospital nurse arrested for refusing to draw an unconscious patient's blood. Those stories and others ahead on the show. And joining us for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham is with us. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Government reporter Christopher Smart is here. Good morning, Chris.
Hi.
Reporter Luke Ramseth is here for the first time. Welcome to you, Luke.
Thanks.
And also Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh joining us in studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
We also want to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Weigh in with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also post them to the KCPW Facebook page or the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, is being rescinded, phased out over 6 months. The program, which was instituted by the Obama administration, provided work permits and deportation relief to people who were brought to the U.S. as children. This week, President Trump announced plans to scrap that program. And Matt Canham, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor, what effect will scrapping that program have here in Utah? How many people will be impacted, first off?
So Utah has 10,500 people who have DACA status.
Okay.
These, as you said, are the children of undocumented immigrants. They were brought here as children. Most of them are adults. The period where you have to prove that you came here before you were 16 years old and have to be younger than 35 to apply. You can renew this every 2 years with a fee and a government form you have to fill out. But now that's all thrown into question. The president didn't just rescind it, he put a six-month deadline on rescinding it. So it's still in place for 6 months.
Does that mean that renewals of the program are in place? I mean, I guess that wouldn't matter so much if the program is gone after 6 months.
So if your status lasts 2 years, it still will last that period of time. Whatever the government says, you can renew. If your status was going to phase out before next March, you can renew. You have to file in October, by October, some period in October to get back in line. But after that, it's going to start phasing out. But no one appears to hope that's going to happen, even the president.
Right.
The president wants Congress to act. Now, Obama put this program into place after Congress failed to pass an immigration reform plan. And it was a unilateral action that Republicans really disagreed with. They thought the president did not have the authority to do this. And when Donald Trump ran for president, he suggested he was going to eliminate this program, which is kind of where we are today. He struggled with this idea of eliminating a program Republicans think was put in place illegally with a program that 80% of Americans support, including huge numbers of Republicans support this, including in Utah.
I was going
to
say.
So it's a very popular program, but they didn't like the way it was done. And so now that his plan is to make Congress in the next 6 months come up with a way to a legislation to fix this, which Congress has had a hard time passing anything of substance. So this will be a tough lift.
Well, the question is whether or not the added pressure of a six-month deadline and the fact that these people – I mean, DACA meant that these young people could hold jobs. They could
go to school.
That's going to go away with this rescission if Congress doesn't act.
If nothing happens at the end of 6 months or if the president doesn't act again. So after the first uproar on this, the president sent out another tweet saying that if Congress doesn't act, he'll revisit the issue. He didn't explain what revisit the issue means, but it's possible he could do what Obama did and put this program back into place if Congress doesn't come up to an agreement.
Can I ask quickly, Matt, about the responses from office holders? You know, we had various office holders and local officials responding to this. One place where we might start is the split between Utah's two senators over
right.
What should have happened with DACA.
So Senator Orrin Hatch was the first Republican sponsor of the original DREAM Act, which is what DACA is based on. That was in 2001 with Senator Dick Durbin. It was the program that this whole thing is based on. And that program, unlike DACA, would have led people to have permanent legal status here over a period of time. And it has lots of support, but never got over the hump, mostly with Republicans. So Senator Orrin Hatch was – he called Donald Trump beforehand to ask him not to remove this program. He has since been very strong in saying that he's going to work hard to get Congress to do this, and he's very upbeat about Congress's chances of getting this done. For Mike Lee, who is more of a hardliner on immigration, the two senators split during Obama's tenure on this immigration bill. Orrin Hatch supported it. Mike Lee did not. For Mike Lee, this is more about process. He's more angry at the way that Obama did this, didn't think it was right, and thinks Congress should come together on some way to get this done.
You know, actually, I'm thinking about this. Getting this done, is what does that actually amount to? Is it a revival of Senator Hatch's, you know, Dream Act? Is it right. Which, and maybe you might have to explain what that was.
Right. So the Dream Act originally would allow the same group of people who came here as children but were younger than 35 to go to school, to hold a job, if they met certain requirements and stayed out of trouble. And then over a period of time, they would be allowed to apply for permanent legal residence in the United States. So really, I think there are three paths forward. There is some version of the Dream Act that you could pass now on its own, which would have a lot of support. You could pair that with Donald Trump's plan to build a border wall and try to make it a combined bill of those two issues. Or you do the really hard thing and you go back to what George W. Bush and Barack Obama tried, which were comprehensive immigration bills, massive pieces of legislation. And there are members of Congress who have proposed all three in the very short period of time since Donald Trump has rescinded DACA. All three of those are on the table.
Okay. And maybe we'll circle back around to that. I want to bring Paul Raleigh, opinion columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune, into this and get your thoughts on what's happening. The president is making good, as Matt said, on a campaign promise to do away with this program. It's, you know, at the same time, upending 800,000 lives across the United States.
Well, like Matt said, you know, you could see him starting to walk it back a little bit when he say he might revisit it after the pushback that he got. And you know, Matt pointed out, I mean, it's most of the people in this country support it. This is just another example of kind of the shift in the attitude. I think the attitude was softened quite a bit under the Obama years about people who live here, even undocumented, you know, if they did certain things. And now, I mean, let's face it, Trump ran on, you know, building the wall and all the kicking all the illegals out and all the rapists and everything in here. And that's his base. His base support that. And so you've seen a real hard line new twist to this whole issue. And, you know, we've been reading stories now for quite a while, or the last few months, about people who have been here, they followed the rules, and all of a sudden, you know, when they felt safe under the Obama administration, now they're getting, something happens, they get deported. Somebody had a citation in 2007, and they use that, a father of four little kids, to deport him. And you're just seeing this, a whole new shift now, and I believe that, you know, people who have lived here for quite a while and came here as children rightly have a lot to fear under this new atmosphere.
Well, and I've heard commentary over the past few days from people who say these are kids or young adults now who, you know, came up through elementary, middle school and high school in American communities that, you know, the American communities that they grew up in, and they might be your coworkers and neighbors, and it's hard to think of them as somehow less American. A lot of them
have served in the armed forces for the United States.
Right. And Matt, what I'm wondering is, if Congress can't resolve this, if we don't have something happen and these 6 months go by, what happens then? Are these young people, some of whom only know America as their home, are they going to get deported?
Well, the government has not said they're not going to. What the president has said is he will not take action in the next 6 months. The administration has been asked the question of what action they're going to take, and they have not made it clear. But if you are one of these people who have DACA status, you're not only worried about whether you can be deported. By coming forward and giving the government your name and address and where you work, you've opened up your family to be found as well. And so there's an incredible amount of fear there. This is also a pretty coordinated group of people who understand politics. when I covered the Obama administration's attempt at immigration reform, I was in the committee hearings in Congress. The group that was there every time was the Dreamers, every day, for the entire for weeks and weeks of hearings. That group took up multiple rows. This is going to be a lot of political pressure because it's not only this group, it's chambers of commerce, it's religious organizations that are all supportive of this. And it's, as I said before, big populations of Republicans and Democrats support this. In Utah, it's Orrin Hatch. It's Attorney General Sean Reyes. There are political leaders who are going to fight this.
I want to remind our listeners that we welcome your thoughts on this. This is a news roundup with reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune, but we'd, of course, like to hear from people directly impacted by the stories that we're discussing today. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. You mentioned, Matt, a couple of the sort of reaction from Utah leaders. There's also reaction from religious leaders in Utah. The bishop of the Catholic diocese decried the move to eliminate this program, for example.
Yes.
Have we heard from the LDS Church?
Not officially.
Okay.
The LDS Church has in the past come out with immigration statements saying that they believe that the government needs to come up with a solution that allows immigrants or undocumented immigrants to understand their status in this country. But on this, at this moment, they didn't come out and make a statement. As you pointed out, the Bishop of the Catholic Diocese here, Oscar Solis, had a pretty strong statement, and the Catholic Church has been more outspoken on immigration for years and years. He said the administration's action represents a heartbreaking moment in our history that shows the absence of mercy and goodwill and a short-sighted vision for the future.
Hmm. Also, another person in the House of Representatives, we mentioned our senators, but someone who is the child of immigrants in the United States is Representative Mia Love.
Right.
Did she respond to Trump's decision to rescind DACA?
She did. It was not as forceful as the bishop I just pointed out. Mia Love's parents fled Haiti, moved to New York, and Mia Love was born in this country shortly thereafter. She said that she's obviously very sensitive to the position these young immigrants find themselves in, but she also goes back to the process. And she says from the beginning, Congress should have had a solution. It's easy to say Congress should act on immigration policy. But the last time Congress acted was the 1980s. So it's clear that this is not something that's so easy for Congress to do, even though it's obviously the job of Congress.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, Roger and Matt, is that my understanding is that there were 10 states who were suing the administration over to get rid of DACA. And now my understanding is that there are 15 states suing to keep it. Is that going to play out in any way?
So the whole reason we're talking about this now is an artificial deadline created by 10 states led by Republicans who threatened to sue the Trump administration over this issue, pointing out that the president campaigned on eliminating this program, and if he didn't act by this Tuesday, they were going to sue. So the president acted by this Tuesday. Since then, there have been 15 states like Washington State, New York, who have sued to say that to try to block this action. That will go through the courts. How that works, I'm not sure. The Washington Attorney General, his argument is that not that the president couldn't take this action, but the reason he is taking this action is a disqualifier. The Washington Attorney General is arguing that Donald Trump is doing this because he doesn't like Mexican immigrants.
Right.
And that is,
and it's similar to the argument that the same state used in suing the Trump administration on the executive order on refugees and immigrants
exactly
coming into the country. Okay.
And they had some legal success, so that might work in this case, but we'll have to see how the courts respond.
Matt, you mentioned something that as part of DACA, people registered for approval of that program with the federal government. They provided a lot of information. Might that information, I mean, this is the fear that you brought up, that information could conceivably be used against them by immigration law enforcement or against their families?
Yes. I mean, they have to fill out a form. They have to check in every 2 years. They cannot commit crimes. They have to pay their taxes. They have a fee. So all of this is information our government has collected and tracked and would be easy to use if the government decided that their status is now null and void and that they are not in this country illegally. They could be picked up. I don't know if that's going to happen. As Paul Raleigh has said, we have seen some people being deported for reasons that the last few presidents would have looked at as a pretty minor reason to deport someone. So we'll have to see how this administration goes. It's clear that in the Trump administration, there's a variety. There is some movement of views. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is a very hardline person when it comes to immigration, including on this issue. He refuses to call them dreamers, which is the word that proponents have put on this group as to try to make them sympathetic. He won't call them that. But Trump has used it repeatedly, and even in announcing this, said that he loves the dreamers, and he wants to figure out a way to keep them in the country. So we'll see where this goes.
And again, you know, for some of them, that might mean, you know, if they weren't able to stay, deporting them to a place that they might not remember and to, right. You know, where they might not even speak the language.
Yeah, I mean, we talked to a person named Francisco Juarez who came to this country when he was 6 months old. He said he's American in every way except on paper.
You know, I want to turn to a related story, which is a story about a government database potentially being mined by immigration officials to round up people living here who don't have legal permission. And actually, though, we first have to head to a quick break before we do that. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and we will return in just a moment. A reminder once more to join this conversation with your comments and questions. The number to call, 801-355-TALK. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Christopher Smart, reporter Luke Ramseth, senior managing editor Matt Canham, and Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh. As we do every Friday, we're discussing this past week's local news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us again, 801-355-8255. And before we went to the break, we were talking about DACA and the fears that the information provided by enrollees in that program, that information might be used against them. And there's a story that Tribune reporter Christopher Smart reported on this week that has some parallels. It has to do with something called the Utah Driver Privilege Card. Chris, let's start there. What is this card? When and how did it come into existence? And it's kind of a driver's license, right?
Yeah, in 2005, the legislature recognized that there were undocumented aliens who were driving illegally, and they wanted to do something about that. They wanted them to get driver training, and they wanted them to get insurance. So what they did is they came up with a solution. They called it the driver privilege card. And so an undocumented immigrant could go and pass a driver test and then get insurance. And so because we know these people need to drive to get to work, buy groceries, et cetera. So and this was the solution. Now, at the time, there were voices saying, look it, if these people give their information to you, including their home address, then it could be used against them. The immigration guys could come and take them and deport them because the information would all be there, including the fact that they don't have documents. But the legislature said, no, we'll make it so that that cannot happen. And so lo and behold, all these years later, an immigration attorney by the name of Aaron Tarrin one week ago, sent out an email to his colleagues, other immigration attorneys, saying that it appears as though the immigration officials, ICE, are using that data to find undocumented immigrants and deport them. And so what his firm said had a situation where and they need to renew these things from time to time. And so his firm, he said that there were a couple dozen folks who had renewed and then immediately were contacted by ICE for deportation.
Can I ask, how is ICE, you know, we don't, obviously, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, they don't say if or how they might be using this database. Is that correct?
No, they don't comment on their investigative techniques, so they won't say if they're using it or not.
If do we know where they might actually be accessing the database? I mean, is it through state computer systems?
Yeah, okay. So the way this works is that any law enforcement agency has access to this data if they believe a crime is being committed. So State Senator Luz Escamilla last week took this information to the commissioner for public safety here in the state, Keith Squires, and said, hey, look, we're getting reports that this data is being accessed for this purpose, and reminding them that, you know, guarantees were made that this would not happen. So the Department of Public Safety looked into it, and after a few days, they determined that that wasn't the case because the driver privilege cards data was in the same database as regular old Utah driver's license holders. So that is to say, you couldn't tell which person was which unless you had more specific data. But Senator Escamilla says that if you have the name of a person who is undocumented, then you can use that database to find their address. And so she says she believes it is happening because the sort of the anecdotal data, which I guess that's an oxymoron, but these things are cropping up and all the time now.
Sort of qualitative data, I guess, might be the way to say. So one, I don't know, this is an interesting, this is kind of about how the priorities of immigration enforcement play out, you know, how they might be, how immigration enforcement officials might be thinking about or implementing a policy by which they go after people who are here in the country illegally. And that has maybe changed since the election.
Well, and that's what Matt Kahneman pointed out. Under the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations, unless you committed a felony and you were undocumented, most likely they weren't coming after you because there are just so many immigrants and so many, you know, federal law enforcement officers. But now, under Trump, that has changed. And if you're here without documents, they can and will deport you because you're here illegally, period. But as Paul has mentioned, that even people who might have had a misdemeanor years ago also are getting deported. So it is a new day. Now, what this attorney Aaron Tarrant told me is that, and of course we can't have a dialogue with ICE. They will not talk to us. But what he says is that his claim is that, look, there are bad people out there who are undocumented. But by and large, most of those folks, the vast majority of those folks are very hardworking, keeping their nose clean, just want to put bread on the table for their families. But he says so that ICE could be going after the bad guys, but if they've got this way that they can...
Right. It's sort of low-hanging fruit.
They're going after the low-hanging fruit, and that's their complaint, among others.
I want to bring Paul Raleigh back into this conversation. The intent here is kind of similar to that of DACA, to provide a way for people to come out of the shadows, give them a legal way to, well, in this instance, to drive, which if you're here, you obviously need to do. I mean, I just see a parallel here between the you know, how immigration enforcement is happening in the country, and I guess this is the point that Chris has just pointed out you've made in the past.
Right, and I'm basically going to repeat what Chris said, but you know, my opinion is that it's the atmosphere that's now been created in the world of Donald Trump in the United States, and like Chris mentioned. President Trump used the excuse of immigrants here who have committed violent crimes and we need to clean it up and we need to get the bad guys out. But that's not what's happening for the most part. What's happening is they're going after the people who have followed the rules and who are easy to identify because they've followed the rules and because they have jobs and because they register and everything else, because they're the low-hanging – they're easy, and that gives the administration the opportunity to show how, you know, determined they are to get all these, you know, illegals out who are committing crimes and stuff.
Chris, is it possible that, I mean, could, you know, we're talking about the priorities of immigration enforcement. Is it possible that if ICE were, or, you know, could ICE be targeting hardened criminals, say felons, people with felonies who are inside of this database? Wouldn't that make a difference in sort of the, well, at least the perception of what they're doing?
Well, that's possible. But what I'm hearing from immigration attorneys and advocates is that these folks, when there is something in their criminal history, it's usually the stuff that Paul had referred to, which was you might have something 10 years ago, which was not a big deal, that at the time they let slide and this time going not so much. But they do, I mean, ICE is out there looking for criminals, hardened criminals, but they're putting out a wide net.
Is there a quota that they are supposed to meet in terms of anything? I mean, no, not necessarily.
They won't answer that question.
Okay.
They won't answer any of our questions, really. But it, what this, going back to the in the shadows with, and this applies to DACA and too, is that these attorneys now are faced with advising their clients to drive illegally for fear of getting deported. So it puts them in an ethical bind. So they're not ever supposed to tell a client break the law.
Right.
But in this case, they might do that and have these folks go back into the shadows.
Or at least advise against getting this driver privilege card.
Yeah.
and not necessarily say anything about the driving. I have a quick comment here related to the shadows. This is Melly, who called in and said that most DACA children were brought to the United States as young children. They shouldn't have to suffer consequences of choices made by their parents. They consider themselves American. Trump says he wants to make America great again. DACA youth are contributing to making America great again. I mean, this is the common sentiment. Again, 80%, as Matt Canham said, of Americans are – well, I don't know if it's – that's precise a number, but a large number of Americans are in favor of this program.
It's roughly 80%.
Okay.
And this is why I think there's the sentimental aspect, but there's also an economic one, which is why you see the Chamber of Commerce, both the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as well as the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, and major businesses jump on board on this and say that this needs to get fixed or changed, because these are young people who are contributing to our economy. And as the United States gets older, we're going to need more younger workers. These people are here and essentially American in every way since they've been here as little kids. That's why there's a lot of economic pressure as well.
Chris, just circling back to the driver privilege card for a brief moment, is there a way that, say, state lawmakers might be able to address the fact that this information is being – is there anything they can do to change that?
You know, it's hard for me to say, but if it is in fact the way that Senator Escamilla is putting it, it seems unlikely. But it just – getting back to Matt's point right now,
yeah,
about the need for workers, we know that places like Park City, Utah could not exist – without these folks. We know that the hotels and restaurants and some of the biggest advocates for
keeping these people here is agriculture. I mean, this country really runs on immigrants.
You know, both of these stories are sort of not resolved yet, and I'm sure that they are both things that Chris, Matt, and others at the Tribune will be following up with on this beat. And Chris, we'll bring you back in for a follow-up at some point, I'm sure. I'm just looking at our time, and we should probably turn on to other stories from this past week's news, and maybe one of those that gained the most attention was a viral bit of news from last week and that kind of bled into the Labor Day weekend and is still spreading. And this was the arrest of a nurse at the University of Utah Hospital who refused to draw blood. Refused a blood draw request by a Salt Lake City police detective because the detective didn't have a warrant and the patient in question was unconscious. Luke Ramseth is a reporter who has been following the story closely. And Luke, thanks again for being here. I've just given the basics of the story. Police body cam footage, it went viral on the internet, and it sparked a lot of public outrage. And I don't even know if we need to set this up because it's been so widely reported, but right. Can you maybe quickly walk us through what happened? Why, for example, were police trying to get this blood sample? It has to do with a car accident, correct?
Right, car accident up in Cache County. Utah Highway Patrol was chasing kind of an erratic driver, and he collides with a trucker head-on. The suspect died. The trucker is taken to the hospital down here. And as part of their investigation, Logan Police felt like they would like to get a blood sample from the trucker, even though he was just
a sort of victim.
Victim. And so they put in a request down to Salt Lake City Police Department. Can you go get us some blood from the burn unit where this trucker was? And that's kind of takes us up to this officer who comes up to the burn unit to get the blood.
Right, and he is he's told no, you can't get it because this patient is unconscious and you need a warrant. As a result, this nurse Alex Wubbles at the University Hospital was arrested for essentially following the policy of her hospital. Was she also following state law or a law relating to conveying evidence? Is there a specific legal procedure or a law on, you know, needing a warrant to get blood from unconscious patients, I guess, is the question that I want to ask.
I think it's a little bit muddy there with some factors like implied consent, whether if you have a driver's license, does that mean that you're giving consent? But the bottom line is that she, as she points out in the video, the hospital has an agreement with the police department, and that requires that the patient either gives consent, police have a warrant, or they have this person under arrest.
Got it. Well, you've been covering the aftermath of the arrest, and there's a lot of that aftermath to the point that I'm not really certain where to jump into this, but maybe we can start by talking about the public outcry, you know, from far afield and locally. A lot of people calling and emailing the Salt Lake City Police Department to complain about this incident and what they saw in the video, correct?
Yeah, there's been a huge response to it towards kind of anyone who's been involved. I mean, our stories have been read, I think, millions of times. And the police department really felt some backlash to the point where the day after this video was released, police were kind of struggling because dispatchers were being a little bit overloaded by callers who were calling in and saying, that Detective Payne should be fired or just kind of generally complaining about what they saw in the video.
Well, and part of the criticism was that police didn't act quickly enough when it came to, you know, suspending Detective Payne or putting him on leave. That was part of this. And actually, there's a comment that a listener emailed in. Glenn says, the real question is, when did the police and the city know about this assault on the nurse at the University of Utah? It appears they became interested only after the video was made public, months after the incident took place. Is that an accurate statement? And then when were people aware of what had happened, both within the police department, say at the administration level, and in the mayor's office?
So the police says that they were aware of it really quickly after it happened. I mean, this was kind of a big deal up at the hospital that day, and so they say that the hospital, some hospital officials called and contacted the assistant chief, Tim Doubt, to kind of let him know what had happened. And they had a meeting the next day with hospital officials as well as a couple other players, including the university police chief, about this incident. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they put Detective Payne. They took him off the blood draw team, but they did not put him on administrative leave. So they were aware of that then. At least some people had seen some video. But as this listener says, you know, the video wasn't out there widely. The police department didn't release it until just last week.
And when the mayor saw, when Mayor Jackie Biskupski saw this video, she was among those who had some criticism, said that that Officer Payne should have been put essentially on leave immediately at the time. Am I putting words in her mouth that she didn't say, or did she say that?
No, she did say that this week, and in kind of she posted kind of this frequently asked questions, and I think presented it to the city council as well, saying something more drastic should have happened to Payne, including being put on administrative leave right after this happened, as opposed to just being taken off the blood draw team, which is kind of a team of these officers that go and get blood in these situations.
This is kind of an inconvenient time for this, but we've got to take a break in the show. And Luke Ramseth, when we come back, I want to ask you about what steps the police have taken since this event took place, the status of this detective, among other things. But right now we've got to head to, as I said, another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Luke Ramseth, Christopher Smart, editor Matt Canham, and columnist Paul Raleigh. And you can add your comments and questions to this Friday morning news roundup by calling 801-355-8255. Or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Luke Ramseth, we've been talking about the story of the aftermath of a story that went viral, the arrest of a Utah nurse who refused to provide police with an unconscious patient's blood sample without a warrant. So there are now some investigations underway. And actually, maybe before we dig into that, what is the current employment status of the officer from the story, Detective Payne?
Detective Payne is as of last Friday, was placed on paid administrative leave, as was another officer who we don't for sure know who that was, but we believe it was Lieutenant Tracy, who was also the other officer that was up there at the time when they were trying to get this blood draw.
And meanwhile, Detective Payne has also lost his part-time job with Gold Cross Ambulance.
That's right.
Part of that has to do with some comments that he made that he's heard making during the body cam recording of this incident.
Yeah, he makes some kind of interesting comments in the aftermath, talking about he kind of ponders out loud how this is going to affect his Gold Cross job, which is kind of his side paramedic job, and then also says something about sort of retaliating maybe against the hospital just in terms of bringing them some. He says transient patients and that kind of thing, and it's hard to really know what he meant by that, but the ambulance company didn't appreciate it.
Hmm. So the story has almost too many facets, but let's jump into the investigations that are now underway, and I guess maybe I'll just ask you about them. How many are there, and who's carrying them out?
There's three underway. There's an internal affairs investigation by the police department looking into this incident. And then there's a police civilian review board investigation also looking into the incident. And then as of last Friday, the district attorney requested that there be a criminal investigation, and that's being carried out by Unified Police, Salt Lake County. And then yesterday we learned that, right, that the DA would also like the FBI to kind of look into this as well.
What would Salt Lake County Attorney Sim Gill? What would he want the FBI to be looking at here? I'll just pose that question. Why the FBI?
I don't know quite the extent of it, but I think he's looking for some possible federal violations here related to civil rights, color of law issues that the police may have violated.
Before we go too much further, I want to bring Paul Raleigh, opinion columnist, in on this. And Paul, a simple question: what do you think of what happened here, and maybe, you know, kind of more importantly, why do you think it happened?
Well, there are some obvious policy problems. You know, Jackie Biskupski said that she didn't know about this incident until the video came out from the nurse's attorney. Well, she should have known. When you're seeing all the reaction now, you're seeing Sim Gill talking about a criminal investigation, and you're talking about civil rights violations, and so there was obviously some severity to what happened here that should have been reported up the chain. The mayor should have been aware of it. The police chief should have been made aware of it. We didn't hear from the hospital administration until this came out. Now they say that they were, showing concerns and behind the scenes before that and everything. But I think you could arguably say this was a false arrest. This was an assault on a nurse who was just doing her job. And if Mayor Jackie Biskupski did not know about that until the video came out, she needs to put policies in place to make sure that when something like this happens, she finds out about it right away so she can deal with it.
Luke Ramseth, what sorts of policy changes have happened as a result of this incident?
Well, just going off what Paul said there, I mean, the one of the kind of ones related to the mayor include that the mayor would like to be put in the loop on these kinds of things, and it's unclear what that policy is going to look like yet for her, because she apparently was not made aware. Maybe someone in her staff, maybe her chief of staff, sort of knew a little bit about it, but it just did not make it to her. But there's going to be a few other. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you would imagine it would be hard to figure out what the cutoff point for being informed. When the incident becomes, to what point do you get that video yourself for the mayor to be watching it herself? Other policy changes, though, include at the police department, some at the hospital.
The police department has kind of rewritten its blood draw policy to say that you either have to have consent or you have to have a warrant, and they made that very clear, and there's no longer any mention of this other implied consent or anything like that.
Okay, and then at the University Hospital, there was a policy change that has been implemented so that nurses will no longer be a point of contact for the police. If I'm not mistaken, Chris Smart, I think maybe you covered this story.
That's right. This was unusual because I was working Monday, the holiday. And at about 10:30 a.m., we got an email from University of Utah Hospital administrator saying, and we're having a press release and a press conference in 30 minutes. It's like, wow, but isn't this the holiday? What's going on? So it turns out that on TV that morning, national TV, Nurse Alex Wumbles was on the Today Show talking about what had happened to her and her sort of shock and disappointment in a system that had let her down. Now, she sort of pointed to the police in this instance and the security. She actually called hospital security because she was afraid Detective Payne was going to go off. Mm. So we went up to the news conference, and all the honchos were there, and they said that they had been developing this new policy since the day that this false arrest occurred. And so the new policy is that no law enforcement officer can interact with a nurse or other care provider at the hospital, that if they want blood or something else, then they have to go to the hospital administrator that is in charge at that moment. So, and they have these administrators are on 24/7. There's always somebody at the helm. And so no police officer can interact with a nurse or other health care provider, and they cannot be in an area where care is given to patients. And so they're saying that, you know, this is the wall that we've created, so this will never happen again.
Okay, so this is interesting also because there is this bond between law enforcement officials and emergency medical technicians, nurses, healthcare providers. This is something that people have talked about. I don't know who can comment on this, Paul. You know, we hear about nurses who are making their way to the hospital and are going maybe faster than they should be, get pulled over, and cops will let them go because of that relationship that exists between.
One thing that bothered me about the whole video, well, many things bothered me, of course, but, you know, as Chris mentioned, you know, she called for security. Well, two University of Utah police officers came and were there. And it was their jurisdiction, and they're there to protect the employees, the patients, the visitors, the hospital. And they witnessed an assault and on this nurse and did nothing. I don't know what the protocol is between police agencies, but this happened on their turf and on their jurisdiction, and they did nothing to protect this woman.
Matt Canham, do you want to weigh in on this at all? Salt Lake Tribune, a senior managing editor of the Salt Lake Police, were getting some good press not that long ago for de-escalation training that they were doing. This is not good press.
This is a black eye. This is a huge, and this is the hard part with law enforcement, is that one situation can really change how you see things. And this is one where the department didn't handle it appropriately at the moment, and the department has acknowledged that. And the mayor doesn't think the department handled it in the moments afterward, for the weeks afterward. And so she's looking for some changes there. This is one where the video changed everything. Mm-hmm. And if there wasn't that body cam video, I don't think there would be any reaction. I mean, it's so violent when you see it. It's pretty amazing.
Well, and it points to something that actually appears in that body cam video, which is that there are some interesting sort of there's almost like conspiring going on, or some hints of conspiring between officers before it was mentioned that, look, actually the body camera is on, and therefore, you know, we can't be having this conversation. Luke, am I remembering that accurately?
Yeah, there's some interesting footage after the fact, just kind of Detective Payne's body camera is on kind of this whole time and takes this all in, but there is some interesting chatter later just kind of saying, should I still have it on, kind of thing. Is it on, that kind of thing. So yeah. It's a little bit revealing, I guess.
Paul Raleigh, go ahead.
I'd just like to mention one more thing in Luke's story. The Logan Police Department, actually, when he was telling them he was having trouble getting a blood draw, they said, don't worry about it.
Right.
They were the ones who made the request. They said, we can get it other ways. You know, don't worry about it. No worries. And this guy decided to escalate it anyway.
Luke, this is something that you reported on it was in this morning's paper, essentially, mm-hmm. that he was saying he was getting pressure to provide this blood sample from Logan, and that actually wasn't the case.
I don't know if anybody said that they were being pressured to get this, but I think people were kind of curious if that was the case, why Detective Payne was so motivated to get this blood sample. But what the Logan police chief told me was that we put this request in, and then Detective Payne called us back, and my detective, the Logan detective, said, it's okay, we're going to go, we can go a different route here. And what I reported on today was just that what actually Detective Payne's, his body cam footage actually kind of confirms that, because he's having a conversation with his fellow officer, and the other officer asks, you know, is Logan upset that we can't get this blood? And Detective Payne says, no, it's fine. Hmm.
Well, guys, we are out of time. Unfortunately, some important reporting as usual. We didn't really get much from the nurse herself, Alex Webbles, an enormous flashpoint for her, obviously. Luke, thanks again. I'm sure that you'll be following up on this story. Guys, it's time for our final segment of the show, the underplayed story of the week, and we'll have to keep it kind of short. So, Matt Canham, let's start with you. What is your pick for underplayed story?
The iconic local television newscaster Rod Decker is retiring on Thursday after 37 years. So we at the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW want to wish him the best.
Congratulations, Rod Decker, on your retirement. Christopher Smart, your pick for underplayed.
Okay, so there have been a lot of headlines lately over Operation Rio Grande, which was aimed to, you know, clean up lawlessness downtown among the homeless population. But it's worth mentioning that about 35% of the homeless in this country are under 25, and that another huge segment of homeless people are mothers and children. So when you think of homelessness, it's not always criminals.
Right. Okay, some data on homelessness there from Chris Smart for his pick. Paul Raleigh, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Well, I guess I'll talk about the Confederate flag that keeps popping up at different events.
This is your beat now, Paul.
Yeah, I've somehow become the Confederate. I had a Confederate flag beat now in my column. But the latest one was at the Labor Day celebration by the AFL-CIO. It was during an old car show. Before that, a few weeks ago, there was the Utah County Fair during Demolition Derby. This guy decided to display the Confederate flag. It's popped up in parades, even though people have been told not to display those in the parades.
Right.
And so we'll see if it keeps popping up. It's like a bad penny.
Keeps turning up, right? All right, Paul Raleigh, thank you for your pick. Luke Ramseth, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I want to point out my colleague Pam's story that kind of, I think, got lost a little bit about the Bountiful fire, which broke out last week, threatened a bunch of homes up in the foothills there. And she had a story this week kind of showing that or about the fact that it sounds like this fire was started by a power grinder,
right.
And also that the guy whose property this started on had sent out a letter of apology, it sounds like, to all his neighbors that included some homemade jam. And I thought that was kind of a fascinating little story.
That's great. I had not seen that. I'll check it out. I'm going to just quickly throw in Robert Gerke's column on the Wellsville Founders Day event, The Sham Battle. I'd never heard of it. Check it out. It's an inaccurate recreation of an American Indian versus Mormon battle, according to Robert Gerke. Chris Smart, Luke Ramseth, Matt Canham, and Paul Raleigh, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis, Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. And as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.